You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner-Kent, the editor-in-chief, and I'm here with...
Susie Evans, senior editor.
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And we're welcoming Deep back from a... trip abroad. We're going to talk about her trip to Moscow's Golden Mask Festival, which she just returned from. Then we're going to talk about the bane of our existence. No, not just kidding. The season. We're announcing.
Kind of kidding.
We're announcing
the most magical time
exactly.
In American theater.
It is the season of every theater in the world announcing their seasons for next year, and we're duly reporting them. On our website, you can follow them. Follow Twitter. Follow our Facebook feed. It's all you can see for miles. Seasons and seasons and seasons. And we'll talk about that and maybe some speculation about what plays seem to be rising to the fore. And speaking of which, we'll talk a little bit speculated about an upcoming major award.
The Pulitzer.
It starts with a P. Yes, the Pulitzer.
That's what you're trying to do.
I was trying to tease the suspense, but that's probably not good. Good broadcasting.
A major award? Are we like promoting A Christmas Story?
Yeah, right. So let's see.
Oh, and the interview.
Oh, yeah, there's an interview. Of course. Our interview with Michael Kahn, the outgoing, in all senses, artistic director of Shakespeare Theater in D.C. He was here a couple weeks ago to talk to us about his career and his theater and the future of theater. He's a still a very inspiring figure to talk to. I say still because he's been at it for quite a while. And,
yeah, and he doesn't leave until 2018. So
that's
he
true.
Announced that he's leaving.
But I think he was talking, he wants to not, he's not going to be picking a successor, but he wants to let that successor come in, learn the ropes, and then be able to announce their own season and not have a sort of inherited season as many people do. So he's one of many artistic directors leaving their post, major ones. Tony Taccone, Cary Perloff, Randy Arney, we talked about it before.
Yeah, Kent Thompson, you know, just the...
It's turnover.
Generational turnover.
I guess so.
Not even all generational. Some are just leaving to, like, start freelancing directing more, like...
Yeah, right. But they're all basically of a baby boomer age or a little, or a little older, mm-hmm. in the case of Michael Kahn. So we wanted to talk about this place you went deep. It's this obscure country we never hear about in the news anymore.
Mm-mm.
Tell us about...
We don't know what's happening in the Kremlin. You know, it's so mysterious.
Your experience of Russian theater and of Moscow itself. I don't know where to start. Just go.
Oh, shit. I had notes. We're just going to...
We will cut
gonna,
this.
Like, yeah, we're just going to cut this. And one second.
I thought you had that.
Oh, my gosh. Is this a good outtake? Are we doing this right?
I think this actually will be cut.
I'm sure. But it could be fun.
So, I'll pose it to you again, Dee. Tell us about this country you went to that we hear about in the news all the time. What were your impressions of Russia and Russian theater?
Yes. So, I went to the Golden Mask Festival. It's an annual theater festival. It usually spans two to three months. And it's kind of like a Sundance, but just for theater. So, they have like a presentation of a selection of work that's been selected by a committee. And then they give an award at the end for like best like puppetry, best dramatic work, best music theater. And the interesting thing is, and Rob has been too. So.
I went a couple years ago. Yeah. And I think Eliza went one year.
Yeah, Eliza. And I feel like Jim's been once too.
One of our previous. So it's a junket that the American theater editors occasionally get to go on. But you are the latest, Deep. So tell me more.
Yes. And they have a week in particular just for international buyers because it's not just to present Russian theater to the Russian public, but it's also to present like it to the international community so that they can present it, so they can, you know, tour it worldwide and write about it and publicize and all that stuff. So the part that I went to was called The Russian Case. And the interesting thing about The Russian Case is there's some works that are presented in the case that's not up for nomination for awards in the festival itself. It's curated separately from the festival based on the works that were nominated for inclusion in the festival. And it's just what the presenters thought the thought would be the most tourable slash what they think the international world should know about Russian theater. Okay. And I will be writing about it in this, in the July-August issue of American Theater. So this is just...
This is just you're trying out some ideas here, previewing, right?
What is Russia like, Deep?
Russia was snowy.
It was snowy?
Yeah, it snowed while I was there. It was snowy and rainy. Like, I saw the Kremlin on, like, a really rainy day. So it was very stereotypical, as one would expect. And I spent the first 24 hours being really confused because I can't read the Cyrillic alphabet. So it was just me trying to figure out what the signs said. And then afterwards, me trying to figure out what the words mean after I have read the signs. So it's like a double layer.
It's a two-step process there, yeah.
And, and then while I was there, there was the explosion in St. Petersburg. And so that was on the last night that I was there. And they stood up in the theater and there was just a moment of silence. And that, so that was really beautiful, just a solidarity within that community.
And there were some of the troops I saw, and some of the most exciting theater is happening in St. Petersburg, and they come to Moscow for the Golden Mass. Did you see some St. Petersburg artists as well?
Yeah. So there's a... So apparently, Moscow is kind of like the New York of the Russian theater world, mm-hmm. in that it's very commercial.
Yeah.
Granted, their commercial is not the same as our commercial, which I'll explain in a moment. And St. Petersburg is more like Chicago. It's a lot of, it's more artsy. It's more experimental. A lot of smaller theater troupes, like devising work that's more adventurous. That's not for like a large audience.
Right. It's just doing it for its own sake more, which is the supposedly the Chicago ethic, right?
Yeah. Well, and you know, kind of like more raw, messier, mm-hmm.
right?
That kind of thing. Like there was like an ambulatory show that was in like a Moscow subway station. It was from a St. Petersburg theater.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, there are some similarities and differences. The biggest difference I noticed was it's very director driven. Mm. So it's a lot, it's like the European model of like a director has like a vision how to redo like a classic.
Right.
And so they do like their experimental take on like Chekhov. Mm. And there's also like ensemble troupes, which will devise something together, but it'll be like a meditation on Kafka or like a meditation on Pushkin or Stanislavski. So it's a lot of conceptually driven work rather than linear narrative work. So Susie would hate it because
I would.
Yeah. Cause there's no like playwrights writing,
Living room dramas?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, from the presentations I saw, there were very few living playwrights writing work about living in Russia today.
Hmm. I would like to see that play. Can somebody do that play in Russia?
Yeah, I mean, a couple years ago, Maxim Korichkin, I think that's his name, is a Ukrainian playwright. He sort of feels exiled from Russia. He wrote a play about... It was about house arrest, but it was more linear play.
What you're saying is reminding me about, I've been to the Ibero-American Theater Festival in Bogota, Colombia twice, and they're very director-driven too, but in their like theater practice, the director's also the playwright. So they'll have new plays, but it's like the filmmaker model. It's like writer-director.
Yeah,
right here is like the Eva Van Hove of like, I have this experimental idea about like a Woody Allen films. I'm going to do that.
There's a Woody Allen film?
Yeah, they did Central Park West.
The murder mystery? No, is that the one?
No, the Woody Allen film.
I don't know Central Park West.
I don't
West.
Know that film.
Manhattan Murder Mystery, I know. Central Park West is where Mia lived. He lives Central Park East. I don't know.
It was based on like a Woody Allen script.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So what were some of the highlights? I don't want to cut you off, but.
Yeah, some of the highlights were I saw this really interesting production, this meditation on the life of Kafka. It's like very non-linear and like a lot of digressions. Mm-hmm. And it was directed by, Jesus Christ.
Christ directed it? Wow.
It was like this devised piece. Mm-hmm. By a director named Kirill Serebrennikov.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of this person, I think.
Yeah, sorry. You know, me talking about this is not as good as me writing about it.
Right.
So this is...
Russian pronunciation is
Russian
not always,
pronunciation is not my best thing.
Let me see. What is it?
Yeah. Well, and because the reason we went was just... This was sponsored in part by the Center for International Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they wanted us to go was because, like, there are a lot of up and, like, younger directors who are making their mark on the scene and, like, revitalizing the form and making it more relevant to young people today. A lot of young people in the theater in Russia, by the way. In the audience.
In the audience. Yeah, they said that about Chinese theater as well.
Yeah. And
That's exciting.
Yeah, but... And I'll talk about this in my article too, but I was asking a couple people about it and they basically said, well, television's not as big in Russia. Not a lot of people watch television and the film industry isn't as big and it's a lot safer, like extremely mainstream and safe. And so people go to the theater because they want to see something that's reminiscent of the society they're living in, that's really politically charged, that's really controversial. So that's why they go to the theater.
Do you feel like, there's a trace of dissent in the theater? Or basically, the politics come up, and how do people feel about it? Is that reflected in their theater? Do they feel like they can't go certain places?
So there's this thing where they kind of tell you one thing, but they kind of mean another thing, kind of like a doublespeak.
Okay.
Where the curators were talking, they said, oh, well, the Ministry of Culture had like a big hand in our programming. And then they asked, and then someone asked, oh, so that did that mean like you were forced to change some of your choices? And she was like, no, like we weren't influenced by, you know, by anyone. It's like, wait a minute. There's like a contradiction in there and you're not really making it clear, but I think it's because like there's a line, there's like a hard line.
There's lines, yeah.
But, and so they can skirt up to it, but if they go past it, then it affects their funding.
Right.
No, so like you can't, you know, write a play like we would, you know, criticizing Trump. Like you can't do that about Putin.
Right. That theater doc was I don't think they're still around.
They're still around, but they lost their space.
Did they do any plays at the Little Mask or no?
No, because they lost their space.
They were kind of a Soho Rep type space, and they had done some politically charged work by Maxim Kurushkin and other young writers. And that's a fascinating story. I wrote about that when I went there. But sounds like it was. I can't wait to read what you write about it. You said you were going to talk about the difference between commercial and.
Yeah. So the difference between commercial is like a commercial production would be something like. What I saw was, let's see, it was an Uncle Vanya directed by Mikhail Brickhoff. Brickhoff. See, I was there a week and I didn't even get the language. I'm sorry, guys.
It's okay.
Mikhail Brickhoff, and it was set in the 70s, and it was on like a set that looks like IKEA furniture, like very wood. Like bare wood, and there were like wooden deers in the background and like people, and there was a dance break. So it would be like something you find at BAM, but that was
a commercial production?
That was a commercial production.
Wow. I was going to tell you, it was like it's big musicals or something, but no.
No, they don't have a musical culture.
Right.
I mean, they have they have ballet and classical music, but they don't have like
musical
singing
theater
and
culture.
Dancing.
Yeah, singing and dancing. Huh.
Yeah.
Sad place to be.
That's why they're such sad people, Susie.
That's why the Russians are so sad.
You don't think Natasha Pierre will go there one day, or Dr. Zhivago, or Anastasia?
Well, I think seeing Dr. Zhivago would be sad too. So,
well, we don't have to go there.
I'm sure, if, like Dr. Zhivago, or like had like a postmodern dance break in the middle.
Might be there.
Yeah,
it might be better too.
So
maybe.
Overall, you've been to a lot of festivals. Deep, did you like the theater you saw here? Was it interesting?
I can't say I liked it, but I can say that it was really memorable, and I loved like the resources and what they were able to do,
mm-hmm.
And the line and how far they were able to push the form. Like if you love like form breaking theater,
yeah,
this is the place to be.
Okay, the other.
But if you love linear stories with like. Character development. Yeah. Like there's just sometimes where I was just like, can you just give me character development? Can you give me like memorable dialogue and beautiful words? Because I'm a writer. I love words. Mm-hmm. I love story. And I did not get any of that.
Well, speaking of words, this is something a lot of the plays I saw were not translated at all.
No, they weren't translated.
Some had super titles, a few. And one of them even had actors with headsets?
Oh, they all, for me, they all had, except for one that I saw, they all had a woman in my ear translating it live.
Oh, they did. Yeah. There were a couple of them that I didn't have any translation. I saw King Lear, a King Lear with a female King Lear, and that was kind of a weird auteur take on King Lear, set in a sort of Soviet World War II era. It was kind of striking, but it wasn't a total success, but it was interesting.
But at least you knew it, so you had the script in hand.
Have the script, but I knew King Lear a little bit, so I knew which scenes were happening. And then also, I think I told you about The Seagull I saw by Satyricon Theater. It was like 4 hours long, insane, had characters that weren't in but I knew the bones of the play enough. I knew, okay, this is the scene where this happens, and I can't believe what they're doing on stage right now with that scene. So that's a case where the auteur thing, you could take a text that people know well and then just fuck with it, basically.
Yeah,
you know?
And like insert postmodern dance break and make it really Brechtian. Like they made Uncle Vanya, like they gave it like a Brechtian remove.
Okay.
And like very heavy motifs and metaphors in the characters. And it wasn't like...
Does Chekhov need a Brechtian remove?
Oh, yeah. I mean, checking it, you do it. If you do it straight, it's basically just people talking, right?
Yeah, you do it straight. It's basically like ennui and maybe a little bit of hope for the future. But this production, there was none of that.
I don't feel like Chekhov and hope are equated.
not
usually.
Really.
It depends. I mean, you can make a...
Next year in Moscow.
Yeah, exactly. You can't really do hope and Chekhov as much. Yeah.
But I will say I'm not a fan of postmodern Chekhov, so I was fine just seeing the one.
Right.
But I will say though, it's a very male-driven art form. And so like they still haven't cracked the glass ceiling.
Oh gosh,
yet.
Yeah, that's true. When I think about it, all the directors I saw, I think with maybe one exception. I mean, the woman who founded Theater Doc is a woman, and I believe she might direct a few things, but that's like the Soho rep. They're pretty edgy.
They do like documentary. Theater Doc does documentary theater work, which also isn't like a big genre in Russia either. So that's why they're experimental.
Yeah, and I would just say they do theater documentary, but they do it in a really playful, interesting ways. It's not just, I would love to see their work come here. In fact, I don't know if anybody talked any more about the idea. Woolly Mammoth was going to bring a bunch of these people here, and I think including Kirill Serebrennikov, but there's no talk about that, happening. It didn't happen because the Ministry of Culture suddenly didn't want that to happen. This was about 3 years ago.
Yeah, they
so
have.
So we won't see this work here for
no,
in
and
the
also
near
like some of that work. I got like this brochure, and they had like setup time, how long it takes to set up, how many people it takes mount the show, like how big the stage you need.
Right.
And so some of the stuff, like it takes like 10 hours to set up, and so it's expensive to bring it over.
Right.
There was one play I saw where they had a working shower, 8 working showers. They used it for 5 minutes, and then they didn't. Like, how do you tour that?
I don't know. I mean,
it was amazing. But how do you tour that?
Isn't that like the rain in Glass Menagerie, you know? Like that was only on for a few minutes.
So it was, I look forward to like playing with these ideas a little bit more, but it was definitely one of those times where there was like, I really loved it on a technical level, but I wasn't sure if it, you know, it's not like an emotionally engaging experience, very cerebral, which is great. But if that was a theater culture, I don't know if how I would feel about that.
Right. Well, yeah, maybe you would see other things there that would interest you, but especially Theater Doc's work. I think you would like that if you get to see it.
I wanted to, but then I wouldn't have been able to understand a thing because there would have been no woman in my ear translating it.
Yeah,
for
there was when I saw it.
You know what I did with those shows in Bogota? I didn't understand.
What?
Fell asleep.
And you still wrote about it, Susie?
Well, you didn't write intimate reviews of those shows.
I didn't write intimate reviews about them. If they're speaking a different language and I don't understand what's going on, it's just like a lullaby. It's like,
I tried to watch it like it was dance, you know, when I can't understand the language. No, well, we look forward to that report. Look forward to that report. I think we should segue to the U.S. Briefly to talk about we are entering several seasons a day up to like what? 6 to 10 seasons.
I think it's an average of like 7 to 10 a day.
It's crazy.
Susie's having a great time right now. It's her favorite time of year.
It's all I do all day, every
so
day.
So I have not read all the season announcement in great detail. Is there any trends you can notice or any plays that are rising to the surface?
Trends I can notice. I've noticed that parody is like I'm going to say, a little bit better from eyeballing it. There's still a few seasons to come in with, like, all men writers. And there was one season that came in and was like, a season of female voices. And I was like, yeah, you've got like two women writing and you've got some female directors, but you're still not there on parity with your season.
Right.
But you can see that people are trying. There's definitely some, a highlight of that. And it's also highlighted with, you know, the Women's Voices Theater Festival coming back in DC. And that's a lot of theaters in that area. The two plays that I think will no doubt about it be on our top 10 next year will be Dominique Morisseau's Skeleton Crew and Matthew mm-hmm. Lopez's The Legend of George McBride. Everyone is doing them. Everyone. Wow.
Okay. And The Legend's on there this year, too.
They're at every theater. It's wow. literally like they're very, also Kate Hamill's Sense and Sensibility is a lot of places.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was in one including, today.
Is that the
including
one?
Including Oregon Shakes.
Oregon Shakes, yeah, yeah.
She also has a new one. Or maybe it's not new.
Vanity Fair.
Vanity Fair,
she's
yeah.
doing it right there.
And
right
she's
now,
doing Pride and Prejudice, too.
Wow.
Dang.
So, but Sense and Sensibility is a lot of places. But the two that are everywhere are literally Skeleton Crew and George
Profile,
McBride.
Profile, anybody?
Everywhere. Yeah.
Kate Hamill.
Kate Hamill, yeah. She's everywhere. There's some better parody. Yeah, Deep looks like she has some things to say.
No, I've noticed that Shakespeare in Love is being done.
Oh, yeah, Shakespeare in Love is a lot of places, too.
Why?
Well, it didn't get great reviews in London, but then it went to Oregon Shakes. Or is it coming to Oregon Shakes?
It's coming to Oregon Shakes.
Yeah.
So I think there were commercial hopes for Broadway, so it's weird to me that it's like at so many theaters. It's at least at five or six.
Yeah, it's gotten five so far, including at like the Alliance Theater.
You're asking why a play with Shakespeare in it that was a hit movie? That's a no-brainer, right?
It seems like a big, costly show to do, though.
Yeah, it seems costly. Yeah.
But it seems easy to sell, so.
Yeah.
A Christmas Carol is everywhere.
Yes, exactly. Sansalan Diaries. And then I noticed Enemy of the People is being done a lot, and probably because of water crisis / cuts to EPA
regulations.
Actually,
that's true. There's a lot of different translations of Enemy of the People. There was a new one that's coming to Yale Rep next mm-hmm. season that was announced today, and there's a few others that are happening. Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of Enemy of the People going on.
Yeah, including one that's actually being done in Flint, Michigan this summer.
Wow,
so
really?
That will be.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Or maybe it's in Detroit. Maybe it's in Detroit.
That's worth covering.
Or Michigan. Oh, yeah, we're covering it.
Oh, yeah.
People's Light gave
me the... Let's
get
on that case on that one, yeah.
Gave me the tip on that one. So thank you, People Light in Theater. But I was actually writing down like playwrights who I think will probably be them on the most produced list.
Oh, Lauren yeah. Gunderson.
Lauren Gunderson.
Again, Lauren Gunderson.
She's everywhere. The Word of the Book of Will,
Book of
the Revolutionist.
Will. Yeah, that thing's getting
Silent
done.
Silent Sky. There are
so
a lot of
she's doing
places.
The Sarah Rule yeah. thing where it's not any one play, although there are a few that are.
Book of Will's actually a lot of places next.
But
yeah,
but
it is. Well, you know, I mean, William Shakespeare.
Some years ago, though, when we started doing the playwrights list, there were some who had, on the basis of one play, was being done like 12 places. And there are others like Sarah Rule who had like five different plays being done. And she racked up points that way.
Wait, I just came up with a good story idea for our season preview issue.
What?
Plays about Shakespeare and why they're so popular.
Right. That's
like Book of Will, Shakespeare in Love.
Equivocation.
Equivocation, yeah.
But they're like, those two plays are doing everywhere next season.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, Susie, do you want to write that?
I do
now. I
like Shakespeare.
See, this is how we get ideas. This is how I come up with ideas.
Basically, this is an editorial meeting.
This is an editorial meeting that you're listening to right now.
Yeah.
There's a couple of them out there. There's but, Amy like, Fried had one years called Beard of Avon, which is a playful thing in which about the authorship question. You know, like it's got Earl of Oxford and Shakespeare both in that one. So it's a rich topic.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But those two plays in particular, they're going to get a lot of traction in
yeah.
the regions. And then they'll come to New York and be reviewed tepidly by the New York Times.
Oh, maybe. Who knows? Who knows?
Lauren Gunderson's plays are everywhere, though.
Speaking of the ratification of New York, although that's not really the case, the Pulitzer will be announced on Monday after this podcast is up. And we will be all over that story. And do we have any ideas of who the favorites are?
Dominique Morisseau, Skeleton Crew.
I think Skeleton Crew might be a favorite.
Skeleton Crew.
Really?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, it's so
I think
political.
War might be in there, too.
You don't think
too.
Sweat is on that list?
Maybe.
Wasn't
maybe
Sweat already considered?
No, I think
no,
Sweat.
No, it was considered
Sweat's,
last.
Sweat's no. eligible year was this past year.
I think
year.
Yeah. Sweat is eligible. I
Sweat's
think
eligible.
Skeleton Crew. I think War could be in there.
I don't know if War could be in there.
Is War like, eligible this year?
I have no idea.
No,
I would imagine it is.
War is eligible, but it's not his best play, though.
They like him, though.
I would put my money on Dear Evan Hansen.
Okay,
being
why?
Being a strong contender.
Why? We don't think so. So
no, I actually think it might get a finalist. I don't think it'll win.
I don't think it will. Okay.
I think it'd be rare, as Susie pointed out, for her musical to do it 2 years in a row because Hamilton won last year. I just think it's so rare to have a strong original book musical that's not based on anything. I think it's actually a great book.
I love the music, so I agree that it could, but at the same time, I feel like it's always, they always pick something that's really socially relevant slash off the beaten path, and I don't really know if that would fit the bill.
I think it's socially relevant.
Yeah, I think it has a strong chance. I think Oslo also has a chance.
Oh, yeah. What about Indecent?
Indecent.
Indecent.
Basically,
oh, definitely
the
Indecent.
The ones that we covered in our
Sarah
pirates.
What about Sarah Rules, the Peter Pan?
I heard really tepid things about that play.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's high on the radar.
No. I think Skeleton Crew and Sweat are both pretty high on the radar.
Yeah, I think it might be one of those.
Okay.
Plays.
Yeah.
I say that as someone who's lukewarm on both of those plays.
I am lukewarm on both of them. I did not see Skeleton Crew. I only read it, and I probably shouldn't say much more than that. Other than, I did not know about that one being in consideration. I think Sweat is the one that came to my mind first because it's won a bunch of awards. It's extremely relevant. Mm-hmm. It couldn't have been more.
What about Taylor Mack?
Relevant.
Yes, I just thought about that because he
won the Kennedy
Prize.
Or Viet Gone.
I don't know if that was eligible last year. Viet Gone would be
because Viet Gone premiere.
I would vote for personally, but
Viet Gone world premiere in 2015.
I think it got a lot of critical praise. I think it could be on the radar as long if it was only up. It depends. Evan Hansen premiered at Arena in 2015.
That is true,
but
is
we true. Don't know who submitted
eligible.
It.
I think it was eligible.
I think it was eligible this year too.
I guess if you submit, it depends on the year you submit it too.
Well, I think for a producer like Evan Hansen, I think the producer probably didn't have Arena submit it.
Yeah, I think they wanted to wait till Broadway. And I don't know if...
Or Second Stage. Second Stage was this year, too.
I feel like South Coast would have submitted Viet Gone when it first premiered there,
I think we talked about it as a favorite last year, possibly. Maybe it was on the radar.
Yeah, but oh my God, if they gave it to Taylor Mack, I'm going to be so happy.
I could see him being a finalist for sure.
I don't know. It's interesting because, like, is that...
Not for here.
Is
for
that
the
a text?
Popular
music.
I think the Pulitzer is very much about words and text, and I'm not sure if they would give it
to
a durational performance.
I feel like there's a play we're missing.
I think Bob Dylan's going to win it. No, I'm just kidding.
Wait. I feel like we're missing a play that there's, as a front runner. Annie Baker didn't have a new
there
play this
no
last year.
There are no other plays of any
Let's
merit
see.
Worth
Father Comes Home
about.
To being
Was Father alive. Comes Home?
It well, was that, 2015.
That's at least a couple years old.
That was 2015.
Okay. Because that got a finalist, right?
It did get a finalist last year. Yeah, I think so.
The Wolves?
That could be a dark horse.
That could
I have
be a
heard
dark
about
horse.
That as a dark horse. I think, I think that was a really strong debut. Well, I think this is good. I think we can leave our predictions there.
I feel like we missed the winner.
Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to put my money on Skeleton Crew.
Putting my money on Skeleton Crew.
All right. I'm putting our non-existent money. We'll all collect next week.
Well, you know, I'd be happy to see Darren Hansen win it. I really would.
Yeah.
I would be happy to lose my money if they won, but I'm going to put my money on Skeleton Crew.
I mean, to
Skeleton
me,
Crew or Sweat.
Dear Evan Hansen would be.
You got to pick one.
Would be justice because
don't make me choose between the.
You pick one. I pick one. We'll see who's right.
Dear Evan Hansen is like to me is like what Next to Normal should have been. Like Next to Normal, I'm not a big fan of, and that did win a Pulitzer.
Oh, I'm not a big fan of.
Oh, I love Next to Normal.
And Dear Evan Hansen did all the things that Next to Normal wanted to do. Not all of them, but it was that kind of a show, an intimate family thing with lots of
catchy songs,
and it actually worked. Anyway,
strong book too. It's a good book. It's been very nicely paced.
It's a
I think Stephen Levinson's If I Forget is a front runner for next year.
Oh, is that the one that you forgot?
Yeah.
Did I forget?
No, because you're trying to figure out like which one.
No, it's not. It's not. It's not. In contention this year. It premiered in 2017.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Well, we will report it, and maybe I'll be wrong next week. Let's go to our interview with the venerable Michael Kahn of Shakespeare Theater in DC. Michael Kahn, it's great to have you here. 30 years at the helm of Shakespeare Theater and a long career in Washington, D.C., which is not your native town.
No, I was born in Brooklyn.
And always aspired to the theater?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to be a director at the age of 5.
Oh, wow. So you weren't one of those people who started out as a little ham on stage. You always wanted to direct.
No, I never wanted to act.
Wow.
I mean, that's what I learned to do when I went to performing arts high school and an acting class, but I knew that I wanted to direct. I guess I was a very bossy child.
How did you know what a director was at age five?
I had no idea.
Yeah, no, you're the person who told people what to do.
Yeah. But, you know, I was taken to the theater by aunts and my parents, although my mother, they were not in the theater or in the arts at all.
Right.
But they took me, and so I must have known that somebody organized it somehow.
Right.
But
I
had a little theater company when I was in the third grade and in the backyard.
Wow.
But I was very lucky. I think I said this at a TCG meeting last year, that I went to a school. For first of all, I had parents who didn't mind what
right.
I did.
Okay.
And two, went to Brooklyn Friends School, where even in the first grade, they encouraged me to sort of read a lot. In second grade, encouraged me to write a play and put the play on in the second grade. And and I remember it very well because it was about the Pony Express. And I was very interested in the Pony Express. And so, and I took the Pony Express to Paris and to London. And what was really important when I think about it now, and when I talk about, you know, education in the schools, arts education, that nobody told me that I was stupid or wrong or that I didn't know what I was writing about, or that indeed the Pony Express never did swim across the Atlantic Ocean. And that was the way I think I was treated throughout school, which was that my ideas were worth it. Mm-hmm. My daydreams were not foolish. Mm-hmm. My fantasy, my imagination was valuable. I didn't know any of those things at the time, but when I look at the way kids sometimes are treated now, I see that I was very lucky in the environment that I was brought up in, as opposed to a lot of kids that don't have that opportunity or that privilege to be heard or allowed to blossom in that way.
So did you have at some point or all points or any point a vision of the ideal theater, a vision of the kind of theater you wanted to make? You spent your life making
it. Well, when I was at college, I had a vision of the theater I didn't want.
Okay.
And that was a surprise to me because being brought up in Brooklyn and New York and going to basically Broadway theater, it's what I thought I would be doing, would be doing Broadway theater. And I remember walking down Broadway or whatever we call Broadway when I was in college and looking at all the plays and thinking I didn't want to do any of them except Night of the Iguana.
Okay. Yeah.
And I realized that where my interests had taken me, partly in college, I did Pericles, I did Peer Gynt, you know, I did Jean Cocteau. So I didn't know where I could do what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I began by simply working at Café La Mame and Chino doing really avant-garde plays or the plays of all my friends who were Sam Shepard and Jean-Claude Vanatelli and people like that. And I began with Adrian Kennedy, so I never saw myself as a commercial director,
right.
which is what I guess we called it.
Yeah,
but I didn't know particularly where that would happen.
And then around the same time, if I'm getting my sort of time period right, the resident theater movement was springing up
that's
in the
60s. Right. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I used to go to the Guthrie
when
it first opened.
Right.
You know, I think it was in the 10th the first year before it was built.
Right, right.
And that was a place where I always wanted to do very big, complicated plays.
Okay.
And that was a place I saw that was happening. But it never occurred to me that I could go live in Minneapolis because I was a New Yorker.
Right, right, right.
At that time, it didn't make any sense to me. So it all just kind of happened. But I, and then I got I did one Shakespeare show, you know, for Joe Papp, and all of a sudden that's what I was doing from right. having done plays in coffee houses.
It's interesting. I mean, it's funny. I know the generation of folks who started around the time you started at Shakespeare Theater.
Are we all
I just think Bill Rausch, who now runs a Shakespeare, another Shakespeare theater with Shakespeare name. And I remember he left Harvard in 86 because he looked at much the same way you walked down the commercial street and said, I don't want to direct those plays. He and his colleagues of that generation said, oh, look at the Lort theaters, all these big, you know, bloated white elephants. They're doing old plays. We don't want to be part of that scene. I'm not saying Shakespeare Theater was part of that necessarily, but eventually you became the establishment in a sense, right?
Well, that was, yeah, that was odd.
Yeah.
that was very odd. And I guess I became the establishment in the particular kind of theater I
right,
do.
Right, sure, sure.
I suppose I'm not the establishment if you're a Tony voter or something like
right,
that.
Right, no, and you know. The other thing
But is- I am, yes, I am, and certainly compared to who I was when I got started,
right.
I would be considered very establishment,
yeah, yeah.
And I would certainly want to get rid of me. That's no question about that.
Well, no, you had, I mean, I don't want to downplay, you had a reputation for being a risk taker throughout your career. I mean, and you had, you know, setbacks at the Shakespeare Theater trying to bring your audience along. Am I right?
It was. Well, which theater are we talking about?
Well,
because I have been the artistic director of.
That's true. I mean, I'm thinking mainly of Shakespeare Theater, but because.
Shakespeare Theater Company?
Yeah, Shakespeare Theater Company in
Washington.
That one. That, yeah. the one you're at.
I had a lot of setbacks at the Shakespeare Theater in Stratford, Connecticut.
Stratford too. Okay.
Or
okay.
at the McCarter. They were always setbacks.
Were they to do with artistic risk or just.
Well, they were both, actually. Yeah. So, but we could talk about the Shakespeare Theater Company because
yeah, sure.
I've spent most of my life.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I do remember when I was at Stratford and also running the McCarter, I was running two theaters at the same time, which was really quite extraordinary for me.
Yeah.
But I always had two jobs. It was either teaching or... But I remember that both theaters got into trouble financially mm-hmm. at the same time. And I would go from one awful board meeting in Greenwich, Connecticut to one awful board meeting in Princeton, New Jersey and think, why am I doing this? And finally, I left Princeton because I didn't want to do what I would have to do to save it at the time. I mean,
right.
It's still there, thank God, and Emily's doing a good job. But in Shakespeare Company, when I agreed to do it and agreed happily, I only wanted it if it was possible to do, as I said, as good a job as I knew how.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure what that would be because I hadn't done Shakespeare for a while. But I would never accept that I had to worry about anything but the art for many, many years.
Okay.
And that I would say actually was the strength of the theater, that I wasn't really concerned with should I take risks, should I not take risks. I didn't really know anything else to do.
Okay.
Now, granted, I was doing a repertory that was well known, mm-hmm. but I did do two plays in the first 2 years, which the audience simply didn't know what to do with, although
yeah.
I thought they were classic plays by Machiavelli or by, you know, Thomas Middleton. But that audience was not used to it at all.
Yeah.
The
Witch of Edmonton, is that the one?
Well, it was The Witch of Edmonton,
yeah. yeah.
yeah. And, but I just didn't let that get in the way because I thought if this theater can't do that, this theater shouldn't exist.
Okay.
And I told the people that I met when they asked me to take the job that I didn't believe that saving a theater, which was the Folger Theater at that time, the space, mm-hmm. was the reason to have a theater. And I had, for a year at McCarter, had done things I didn't want to do in order to save the MacArthur
Just
Theater.
To hold on to it, yeah.
And then I left, and yeah. I'm glad it's still there. But I didn't want to do that again.
Well, not long after that, you moved into a new space about
I have to say, I couldn't. Well, first of all, I never planned to be there for more than 4 years.
Okay.
So that was never in my mind for one second.
Oh, so it wasn't like you got there, we got to move immediately.
Well, we moved the theater because all of a sudden, from a theater that didn't have an audience, it had an audience that was larger than the space.
Okay.
And
okay.
What was very surprising to me, although I was very gratified that the trustees who hired me to save a space mm-hmm. actually were willing to move to save a theater company.
Hmm. Yeah.
And irrespective of the space. And that again was about what's more important, the art or not.
Right. Okay.
And for most of my years, that was the challenge all the time, and then expanding what one meant by the art and also what meant by community. Yeah. And that was what kept me there, because every year it was another challenge and another thing to think of. And, you know,
I wanted to ask about expanding the definition of, you've got Shakespeare in the name of the theater, and you worked at another theater that had Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And this is something I've talked to with Bill and other folks who run theaters that have Shakespeare in the title, festivals, a lot of them, but they've expanded to become full-time theaters.
Yeah.
To what extent do you feel like, I mean, have you done the whole canon there? Is that like a...
We have. It turns out we have.
It turns out, yeah. It wasn't like... So I wonder, is there a certain amount of, a certain amount of Shakespeare you have to do each year, a certain cycle through the canon you have to do to keep justice to the name?
Well, it's changed, obviously. Yeah. I mean, we used to do four Shakespeare's and one other non-Shakespeare for a while. And then we did five shows. And then we did more shows, and we never did more than four Shakespeare. Then we added two or three other kinds of plays.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very exciting to me. But, now we do two Shakespeare a year, and hopefully, for the most part, it's because an artist is very passionate about doing that particular title.
Right, right, right.
And or that title connects in some way to what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so I don't feel I have to do sort of rotate the canon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I do wish that the audience was as excited now about doing King John and Timon of Athens than the audience of 9 or 10 years ago. And that seems to be not as big an audience draw as it used to be.
You mean the obscure ones aren't as big in a draw, or just Shakespeare itself isn't a draw?
Well, Shakespeare became the sort of, you know, Shakespeare became the hot playwright of Washington for a bunch of years. And eventually everybody's doing, but you know, Washington, which is a really interesting city. I mean, it is an interesting city to work in, and it's more interesting
time. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah. But,
getting out while you can, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. But there's a new audience. But Washington is still only a certain amount of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of our audience have seen Romeo and Juliet 4 times.
Right, sure, sure.
And unless somebody has an absolutely, blazing idea of what they feel about the play.
Right.
And people do.
Yeah,
and people
sure.
do. I mean, sure. I did when I first got there.
Yeah.
It's the first play I did because I was tremendously worried about teenage suicide and how could I make this play, which solves all its problems by kids killing themselves, how could I use that in some way to reach people about what are the other possibilities?
Right.
And what can you do when a young person seems suicidal? Or what can you tell when a young person is depressed? And would you, Would you speak about it? Would you tell their parents? Would, you know, so I had a reason for doing that play that was very personal to me. I try not to schedule any Shakespeare plays without somebody having that same particular need to tell that story about something that they care about.
Like Ed Iskandar, who we interviewed about The Taming of the Shrew.
I mean, I loved working with Ed. And also that was, you know, I was given a chance by Joe Papp at the age of 25, 26, to direct Measure for Measure in Central Park. I had only done one Shakespeare in college, and I never told him that he came to it and walked out of it. I never told him that. Oh. It was Pericles. We were all very excited he was there, and then he wasn't there during the second act. But I felt very strongly when he offered me Measure for Measure that there was something about it that really was important, which is about hypocrisy and sort of black comedy about hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And so, but he gave me that chance at a very young age, and I have always felt that I want to keep doing that for other people. Mm-hmm. So Ed was one of those people, but also it was time, as it has been, to bring other aesthetics into the theater.
Okay.
I mean, we have an aesthetic of clarity, and we do. People come to the play and say, oh my gosh, I understood that play for the first time or better. And that's important to me.
Right.
But it's also important to me that someone like Ed or some of the other people who've worked there, have a chance to work in a theater such as ours with their aesthetic and with a company that's willing to go with that aesthetic.
Right.
And so, I love that when that happens. When Yael Farber came and did Salome, that was a very different aesthetic and a different way of working than the company had ever had before. Mm-hmm. But, and it took a lot of culture change, you know, to work with somebody who, as brilliant as Yael, but also didn't like breaks, didn't understand the unions, any of that stuff. And really felt it was in the way of her work. So, I'm happy that that goes on at the theater, and so Ed was a very good example of that.
And there's there are plenty of artists that still excite you that are excited to do this work, whether it's Shakespeare or not other Shakespeare. Other classics. Let's just stop for a second on DC, because you started at this theater in '86.
That's right,
the midst of the Reagan-Bush years.
And don't they seem pleasant?
They seem like a halcyon age compared to
at
now.
At least they were understand.
So I wondered if you could reflect on the DC that you came into and the DC that you're leaving. I mean, you could, whether it's political
city. Well, first of all, I mean, when I got to, in terms of art.
Yeah, in terms of culture.
In terms of culture, when I got to Washington, there was the arena.
Yeah.
There was Woolley in a basement. Mm-hmm. And there was Washington Theater Club, which closed.
The studio was there.
And Washington Theater Club, which closed.
Okay.
Neither Woolley nor Studio were, well, Woolley, they were modest theaters. Right. And Arena was the theater.
The big one, yeah.
And the Kennedy Center had opened.
Okay.
Because I had brought some things to the Kennedy Center from Stratford. And, but what interested me, the Folger was a small theater. All the theaters I had worked in were very large theaters and were doing Shakespeare. And I remember once a critic saying that my style was so presentational. And I realized that was actually true, that I had been finally being sort of allowed myself to be bullied by the architecture and the need to get it out there.
Okay.
And so the idea of being in a small theater in a town that was not in New York, you know, was very appealing.
Okay, yeah.
To do Shakespeare. Now, you know, I came from New York and I had certain sort of professional standards, I guess you want to call them. It's a kind of a dumb word, but I had run other theaters and I kind of expected certain things terms of the way things are, the way things look, the ambition of theaters. Even if it was a small theater, I felt the work had to be the best we all knew how to do, and we had to have more rehearsal time, and we had to have the kind of vocal coaches we needed. Okay. So what happened was that theater, people say, I don't like talking about myself, but people say that I had a lot to do with raising the bar of how people did theater in Washington.
Okay, yeah, no, I've read this.
You know, yes. Now there are an awful lot of theaters in Washington.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And there are many good theaters in Washington now. There really are. Mm-hmm. And the standard of acting has changed in Washington because Washington actors themselves, who had very little work, mm-hmm. are now working all the time. So I've seen actors who started when I was there mm-hmm. develop into really wonderful actors. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I always thought it was important to bring actors from anywhere, Chicago, New York, LA, that could do this material.
Yeah.
And I think they have also added to the way people want to be or want to have the quality of the work on their stage. So the Reagan years, I mean, I didn't pay much attention to Reagan because I wasn't tremendously excited about Reagan.
Right.
Although I have to say that there was more consciousness of art during Reagan
uh-huh.
than there has been in the last 3 administrations.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. Which were both Republican and Democratic.
Yeah, yeah.
But meanwhile, the theater has grown.
Right.
As more people see, because the theaters that were there have grown, that it's a possible place to have a theater. So there are a lot more developmental theaters. Mm-hmm. There are a lot more actors coming to Washington to act.
Right.
Some of them are non-equity, of course,
right.
but that's fine.
Huh?
Theaters such as ours are actually paying actors now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in spite of the fact that the funding for theaters got very diminished by both the government and both for the Washington theaters and between the NEA, the Capital Arts Fund, those theaters grew.
Right.
In spite of the fact that there's no corporations in town and the audience has stayed the same, the appetite for theater mm-hmm. has grown.
Right, right.
And so that, I don't think, had much to do with the administration.
No.
And I would say that, sure, I mean, it was better under Clinton and, you know, that there was a lot of excitement all over the country, including artists who wanted to be in Washington with Clinton.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a little like Hollywood on the Potomac for a while.
Okay.
But the truth of the matter was there was a sense of huge optimism that included the arts,
right.
even though we'd had all those problems with the NEA.
Right, yeah. sure.
And the Republican Congress. But what's changed now? I mean, the Obamas really didn't go to the theater. They basically in Washington, they did not really.
Not in D.C. Yeah, they could come.
No,
to
they did
yeah.
come here to, yeah. And yeah. specific plays.
Yeah,
The Clintons got a little mired in the second administration with whatever scandals they were involved
sure.
with.
Sure, well, they had a lot going on.
So, and I don't have a lot of hope at this administration for even mentioning the word art except in a ugly way.
Yeah.
But when we became the enemy during the sort of NEA crisis,
yeah.
it was strengthening to a lot of us.
Okay.
You know, in a way we had, and maybe we were fighting the wrong way. Maybe we were fighting freedom of expression during that. Maybe we should have just fought for the artists themselves.
Maybe, yeah.
You know, there was I think that we were strengthened as a community, that we were under attack for our art.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we struggled more. And that has stayed. And now, of course, the community is up in arms again about,
right.
you know, the lack of whether we're going to have our republic the way we care about it. So I think it had did change during administration.
Yeah.
And of course, different groups of people care about different things. And one had a feeling that the Democrats cared about the arts and going to the theater more than the last set of Republicans did. But
I wonder,
you know, we have everybody, and I enjoy the fact that I can do a play that has something to say about healthcare or something to say about politics. Every Shakespeare play has something to say about politics, and know that the audience, a lot of those people in the audience, actually have something to do with how that turns out.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't believe that a play is going to change their mind, but I hope that a play makes them think about it.
Yeah, I was wondering, would people talk about an age when the theater was more at the center of the national conversation, and they think they're mainly talking about some mythical age when the group theater and Arthur Miller, I'm not sure when they're talking about. And I wondered if being in the nation's capital made you feel like, it sounds like you do feel like your plays
Well, I felt I had a responsibility.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, during the NEA fuss, I did Measure for Measure.
Yeah, yeah.
And during the health care crisis, originally one, Mrs. Clinton's, I did Doctor's Dilemma.
Okay.
And I seem to always do Richard III during a primary season. and do Richard II or Henry V to show what leadership can and cannot be and what are the problems.
Right.
For me, the great thing about Shakespeare is he doesn't write into the plays what the answer is or what he thinks. He allows them to be explored. And that's very good for me to do in that city. So there's an extra perk, no question about doing it.
My question for you, what Shakespeare play is right for this moment? Coriolanus. I know Oscar's going to do Julius Caesar this summer.
Everyone's asked to do Julius Caesar. I mean, it's just not Oscar. I saw Oscar's first production of Julius Caesar. It was pretty good in Providence.
I saw one of The Taper, actually, I think, years ago. Yeah.
And he could still do the same thing, the same video, everything. It'll work out fine. Everybody wants to do Julius Caesar, but I'm going to do Hamlet. And think about Claudius somebody trying to turn all of that into an authoritarian rule and turning all of Hamlet's friends into spies and co-opting Polonius to turn his daughter into a spy. I think there's a lot to be said if you look at Hamlet as both a personal and a political play.
That makes sense. Yeah, and the gaslighting Hamlet, making him feel like he's crazy.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I'll tell you a story. Yeah, I went to a party. I don't go to a lot of dinner parties, but I went to a dinner party, and I didn't know the people there except one person who gave it, who was the head of a agency and then had lost their job the day before, you know. And it turned out at the end of the evening that everybody at that dinner party had either headed an agency or was a cabinet secretary, and they'd all lost their job.
Okay.
And I was the only one who still had a job, which was – but during the – before dinner – I was talking to someone and we were talking about other things, and then the theater came up naturally. And I said, you know, it's so hard for me that you have to plan your season a year and a half in advance.
Yeah.
Basically, we do for budgeting reasons, subscription and all those things.
Yeah.
And I said, so I was really sorry that I couldn't, that this coming up season wasn't going to really reflect what I felt. She said, or that I'd already planned the season we were in. She said, well, what plays are you doing? I said, oh, well, we're doing King Charles III.
Mm.
And then I realized that's about a man who comes in without any experience, takes over the country, tries to change all the rules, and creates a constitutional crisis. And then we're doing Macbeth.
Yeah.
Lethal Tommy's going to do. And then I'm doing David Ives' School for Lies. And then I said, you know, I don't feel so bad.
Yeah, right.
So, and it's interesting that how plays change. I mean, we co-produced School for Lies with ACT and Seattle Rep. And I saw it first in ACT. David Buse from Studio directed it. And when I'd seen it in New York, and I'd felt very sympathetic to Charles.
Yeah, yeah.
When I saw it the other night when we opened in Washington, I was less sympathetic to Charles
Whitney.
And the whole play had turned around for me from, and that's of course the truth about Shakespeare. And that's why, and that's true about the classics for me, that even if you don't set it modern dress or you don't make, you know, necessarily have cell phones, the play resonates right now with something that's very important to the audience.
Yeah.
And so since the audience is very connected to what's going on in the world, in Washington perhaps, as much as New York, but certainly more than many other places, I suspect, that is very exciting to be doing. And the actors feel it, and the audience feels it, and how they respond to certain lines or whatever is is terrific. So, yes.
I feel like everything feels different, including, including obviously the classics. But everything has a different resonance. It especially did right after the election, but none of this seems to be going away, the issues we're dealing with. I want to just close by asking you what, you know, I think you didn't say what you were going to do now. I know you've earned a retirement. You take a break, but I think I read somewhere that you were interested in one day having a talk show or doing like a Charlie Rose sort of thing.
Well, yeah, that didn't seem to materialize, but I have said that I'm going to leave the theater in 2019.
Okay.
Yeah, that's been all over the place.
Okay.
I think it's time for definitely a new person and a new idea. The theater comes to you in many different ways now. It comes to you from the stage. It comes to you in your hand. It comes to you. There's immersive theater and there's site-specific theater. Yeah, there's a lot of ways to produce theater now. And there are a lot of new artists, and I've been very pleased to have some of them there. But it's time. It is really time for someone younger with a lot of the same amount of energy and ideas that I had and courage and to take this theater, which I care about very deeply, further. And it was also very important for me that the person who becomes the director have as their first season their own repertory. We needed to bring in somebody the year before, so they can pick the season after and budget it. Budgeting. Oh my God, I don't have to do that anymore. Budgeting. budgeting the season.
So you'll bring in someone
in 2018,
and you'll announce them, and then sort of.
Yeah,
Sunset hours.
I talked to Bill Rausch yesterday. He said he did the same thing when he left,
Cornerstone. Yeah, Cornerstone.
And Jim Lehrer told me he did the same thing when he left the NewsHour.
Oh, okay.
Very strongly. Joe Hodge is a wonderful guy and he's made a huge success of the Guthrie this year. But for that first year, it wasn't his season. I was lucky because I could bring my critic and Inspector Hound there. So I had a very good time working for Joe, but that wasn't his season.
That wasn't his, yeah.
And I want this person to have their season.
So you're interested in making your succession. Now, do you have a role in picking your successor, or no, you're not?
Well, I'm not going to be on this search committee,
but
I can't imagine that I won't know every single person, no matter where they come from. And I hope I'll be a big resource. There's not going to be any secrets from the search committee
to me.
We're all on the same thing about wanting the theater to exist in a wonderful way.
Well, I hope so. I hope they could find another this generation's Michael Kahn.
Listen, first of all, there's always somebody to replace, and secondly, there are so many bright men and women that are ready. I hope they're ready to take on the leadership of the theater.
And
I think there are more people who are now becoming interested in being artistic directors.
There's a generational shift happening now.
Yeah, and I'm very excited about that. And some of them have been with me, at the theater. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we're looking forward to your last couple of seasons, and hope you stay in touch.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. This was fun.
Thanks, Michael. All right, and we're back with some recommendations of things to see, think about, read, Susie, you have a very enthusiastic recommendation.
I have a very enthusiastic recommendation, and actually I was advocating for it offline, and I just came up with a second theater connection about it. So I am very obsessed with the HBO miniseries Big Little Lies, which is based on a book and is directed by Jean-Marc Vallée and written by David E. Kelley for screen, starring Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, and Shailene Woodley, among others. The tangential theater connection is the young boy who does a lot of like YouTube theater reviews. His name's Ian, spelled I-A-I-N. He's very popular in the New York theater community. Lots of like enthusiastic child reviews. Is actually has a major part in the series, which, you know, he's actually really good. He's a really good little child actor. And another theater connection to it is one of the major plot points in the series, and this isn't giving anything away, is that Reese Witherspoon's character, she's a suburban mom in Monterey, is trying to get the community theater musical up, and it's Avenue Q, and the whole community is against it for censorship reasons. So there's a whole censorship debate about theater in a small community. Which
because
is really
of the
interesting.
Because of the puppet of the
sex. Yeah, there's a whole scene where the little kid, Ian Loves Theater, is like, the kid, I'm calling him Ian Loves Theater, he talks to his mom. He's like, I heard that you can't do this because the one puppet puts his penis in the other puppet. And so,
A lot of reasons why conservative communities would not be okay.
Anyway,
with
there's
that
a lot, there's a big conversation about theater censorship in it. It actually goes across like several episodes, almost all of them. And there's an episode that takes place on opening night where they go to see, oh, that's kind of spoiling night. They go to see whatever show opens at the theater.
Not Avenue letting M. you know. No, just
but it's really
it.
Smart. It's a really smart. It's a female-driven drama. All the acting's amazing. The story's amazing. It's 7 episodes, miniseries, so it's not going to have a second season, I don't think. It's a little bit of a murder mystery. It's really good. I highly recommend watching it.
I'm confused by the title. Are they big or are they little lies? Can they make up their mind? I don't understand.
It's your decision at the end of it.
Okay. All right.
It's like that Russian doublespeak I was talking about.
I guess so. It reminds me of there was a pianist back in the vaudeville pianist called Big Tiny Little, and I could never figure out.
Anyway, it was recommended to me. I wasn't watching it. Someone recommended that I would like it. Loved it. You should watch it too.
I've heard the buzz about it. Deep, what do you
Same.
Have?
Same. I need to go back, pay my HBO account so I can watch it.
I'll give you my password. Go on.
Seriously? Seriously?
Sure, why not?
Oh, my God.
Deep just like feels like she got a promotion.
All right.
I'm so happy right now. Okay. So on that, I'm going to show a little solidarity to Rob. And I'm going to recommend this book that I've been reading, actually, because I'm supposed to lead a writing workshop tomorrow.
Where?
On Friday. There's this Women in Theater Symposium at University of Rochester, and they asked me to, like, help the theater majors and communications majors learn how to write about theater. But the reason that I was reading this book is because I knew it had some sections about the future of theater criticism. And so I'm like, oh, I should probably read this just so I can give this as reading material. And the book is called, The Critics Say, 57 Theater Reviewers in New York and Beyond by Matt Windman. And he interviewed 20 some odd theater critics around the country, including our boss, Rob Reiner-Kent.
I'm in there.
Yes,
yeah.
And they mentioned American theater. Hey. So it was interesting because it's not like one chapter is dedicated to a critic. It's more like one chapter is dedicated to a theme. So you have one chapter about craft, you have one chapter about audience, and the last few chapters are about the decline of criticism and the future of criticism. So it's depressing, yes, but at the same time, if you are going to write about theater, if you want to do it as a student or figure out a way to do it, you should probably read this first so you know exactly what you're getting into.
Right.
And then maybe pitch American theater.
I have to say, even though I'm in it, I haven't read the whole thing because it's almost too close to home. Not just because I'm in it, but just like all the issues are like, it's like reading my mind, like this book about all the conversations or reading my conversations with everybody all the time about criticism.
I feel like you would have written this book, Rob.
Yeah. I mean, I remember doing an interview with Matt. I did it here. I was like pacing around the office doing it while he talked to me about it. And it's fascinating. He talked to most of the, I think is Brantley's in there.
Yeah.
Right?
Isherwood's in there. Yeah. Jesse Green's in there. Yeah. Helen Shaw's in there.
Peter Marks.
So yeah, I mean, granted, it's more men than women because that's just who we have, but it's interesting. They didn't really talk a lot about like
they didn't
diversity.
Talk about diversity. Yeah. I don't think that's
or the lack
a big
of,
theme. Well, that's,
so.
Well, I'm going to just piggyback a little bit in a way on that, and that my recommendation is There's a lot of talk about, you know, diversifying the critical talent pool. And I feel like there are voices out there. Some of them we know about. In fact, most of them we know about because we either employ them or they're our colleagues or they're us. But we don't know about all of them. And what I would love to see artists and theater people, people who care about theater do more of is champion critics as critics. Help us find the voices, young, old, different kinds, different backgrounds that you most love, that you cherish, and hold up their work the way you hold up the new play that opened. You know,
and tell your people, your audiences, to read their work.
Yeah, and I'm not saying being insincere. Like, I think if you really love this art form and you really follow it, you must have read a critic you loved. You must maybe check in, basically support your local critic. Find the critics you love. Find the reviews that you've especially loved. And maybe not just love, maybe ones that piss you off, but engage with them. I'm basically saying, you know, critics are still relevant, and the only way they'll continue to be relevant, and the only way we'll continue this art form and open it up to more people is to champion the work of the people who do it. And, you know, also challenge them. I think the burden is very much fairly on places like American Theater and the New York Times and other organizations to diversify. But we need everyone's help to make it happen.
Well, if there's no publications that are willing to employ them, because people are not reading them.
We are willing to employ them. Exactly. And I guess I'm saying we need to find people who are, we need to catch them in the act of writing somewhere.
This may seem a bit self-promotional because I was asked a similar question of like, oh, as an audience member, how do we help, you know, critics survive? And what can we do in this landscape? And,
share our reviews on social media.
Yes. Exactly. Share our reviews, publicize our work, and also, very simply, subscribe to the publications.
Yes,
yes. Give them money.
Right.
Not saying subscribe to American Theater, though you should give us money so we can employ more people. But if you support us and want us to survive, you can do that with your pocketbook.
And I would just say, and I guess the bare minimum is just to engage with the reviews. If you share a review you don't agree with, or if you share a review that you read and had some thoughts about, just take that extra step. Like, you don't have to write a letter to the editor. Now you can just share it on social media and
write an angry Facebook post.
You could write an angry Facebook post. We don't, you know. I was saying to somebody today, like, critics are only punished by not being read or not being taken
seriously.
There's
actually a whole op-ed in the Times, I think today or yesterday, that Amanda Peet wrote about a bad review.
Brilliant. It was a great piece, especially because I look back, I reviewed that season for Broadway.com, and I was actually really thought she was pretty good in that show, even though Ben Brantley gave a career-killing review.
No, it was Anita Gates.
No. Anita Gates wrote the first review. Oh. And that's when she stopped reading. And then she was talking about Barefoot in the Park.
Oh, right.
Brantley's review was savage. You know, I understood what he was talking about. I thought that was a terrible play and not a great play to put on, but she was okay in it. I looked it up.
At least she's talking about reviews.
Her review, exactly. her piece about not reading reviews is definitely worth reading. I think we should link to that. That's a good recommendation. On that note, all the things we talked about will be linked on our page. And what else?
Review us on iTunes, rate us. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Review us, rate us there. Tell your friends about us.
Well, share this podcast, too.
Share this podcast. Support American Theater.
All right.
Bye.
Bye now.